So without any further ado, I'll hand over the concert platform to Tony Reynolds.
This is a statue of St. Nicholas Owen. It's just figurative because we've got no idea what he looked like. He was just a servant for all of his life, and they didn't do portraits of servants in those days. He was born around about 1562 in the very early years of Elizabeth's reign, about 4 years in. And now England, the religious aspect of England was pretty confused at that time because Henry had only died 15 years earlier, and he was a despite his reputation, in fact, was essentially a Catholic. He believed in transubstantiation, confessing your sins, purgatory, and so on, all of which were no-nos for the Protestant thinkers of the time. But then he died, and he was succeeded by his son, Edward VI, who just reigned 6 years, and under Cranmer, who was the Archbishop of Canterbury, England took a violent lurch into true Protestantism. And then, but he didn't reign long, 6 years, and then we got Mary Tudor, and she, of course, brought us straight back to formal Catholicism for 5 years. And then after that, Elizabeth brought in a less extreme version of Protestantism. So everybody was really, you know, for all those changes, relatively few years, everyone was pretty confused. And there was a lot of people who were just said, well, you know, we're still Catholics. And Oxford, where Nicholas was born, was especially fervent in this, especially a hotbed of recusantism. And the mayor of Oxford once wrote to Privy Council saying there were not three houses that were not filled with papists. And this was about the time of Nicholas's birth. So there's a lot of Catholic people keeping a low profile, but generally tolerated by the rest of the population. The Owen family were a pious bunch. It was headed by Walter Owen, a carpenter, and he had four sons, and all four of them worked for the church, and in Nicholas's case, of course, gave his life for the church throughout their lives. The eldest one was John, who became a priest. Then we had Nicholas, and then after that we had another Walter, named after their father, who also became a priest. And finally there was Henry, who became a printer, and in fact he was the first printer at the Oxford, what is now the Oxford University Press, the biggest academic press in the world. Now, Nicholas, of course, the most obvious thing about Nicholas was his lack of stature. All his life he was called Little John or Little Michael. And we don't know exactly how tall he was. We do know the average height of a man in those days, because this is the Mary Rose, Henry's favourite warship, sank in front of his eyes in the Solent. And as you recall, he was raised in recent years, and we found the skeletons of the archers still preserved in the mud. And from that we know the average man in those days, about 5'7". Now, no idea exactly how tall Nicholas was, but I reckon about 5 feet, about 7 inches shorter than the average, so he definitely would be called Little John. On the other hand, we know he was able to ride a horse. We've got several records of him doing that. And also, in his work excavating priest holes, he got excavated out several cubic metres of rubble and stone at any given time, so quite powerful and strong. When he became 15, he had to decide what to do with his life, and he surely must have considered the priesthood, as two of his brothers had become priests. But I think one reason that very likely would have debarred him was his height, because in Leviticus it gives instructions about who can become a priest and who can't, and people with disabilities and includes dwarfism are not allowed. So it's possible that he wanted to become a priest but couldn't. So he decided to become a joiner. You know, his dad also worked in wood, as we know, as a carpenter, but Nicholas became an allied trade of joinery, where you make furniture, panelling, doors and so on, all to of course much closer tolerances. And I think this skill in working wood to very close tolerances gave him, as we'll see later, the ability to make the entrances to his hides virtually invisible. Let's turn over a page here. There was a significant instance when Nicholas was 19 and in the middle of his apprenticeship. This famous Jesuit priest, Edmund Campion, came through Oxford, and he was a famous preacher, and he was asked by some locals to preach to them. And he agreed to do so at the house of a local recusant, and got no proof of this, but I reckon the Owen brothers, as pious Catholics, would very likely have gone along to this what turned out to be his last sermon, because it was betrayed by a traitor in the household, and 50 pursuivants raided the house. Edmund, with two chaplains, was hurried into a fairly large priest hole, and they searched for them. And the culmination, we have a record of the culmination of the search. A chamber near the top of the house, which was but very simple, having in it a large great shelf with diverse tools and instruments both upon it and hanging by it, which they judged to belong to some crossbow maker. The simpleness of the place caused them to use small suspicion in it, and they're departing out again, but one in the company, by good hap, espied a chink in the wall of boards whereto the shelf was fastened, and through the same he perceived some light. Drawing his dagger, he smit a great hole in it and saw there was a room behind it. So they broke into the priest hole, arrested all three of them, and later the Campions suffered the prescribed penalty for high treason, hanged, drawn and quartered. It's hang by the neck until you're not quite dead, cut down, disemboweled, castrated, beheaded and dismembered with an axe. Just to underline their displeasure. Now, I think the important thing here is that the poor construction of the priest hole that caused us to lose a very capable and senior priest. And as it took 6 years to train a priest, this was obviously something that had to be sorted out. So anyway, we come to about 1585, and Nicholas had completed his apprenticeship and was now a journeyman and could earn his own living as a joiner, and would have been making a reasonable living in the prosperous town of Oxford. And it was also in that year that his brother John returned to England. Priests obviously couldn't be trained in this country. They were sent over most often to Flanders to be trained up and ordained. He came back, but within a year he was captured and sentenced to the Marshalsea, which is the main holding prison for recusants. Tension was high in England at that time, and antagonism was growing against Catholics. And the reason for that is because it was two or three years before the Armada sailed, but already the word had come back to England that the Spanish were outfitting a great fleet to attack and depose Elizabeth. And recusant houses were searched again and again, and any weapons not deemed necessary to protect the house were seized. For Nicholas himself, it was a time decision. He could have gone on as making a good living for himself, but he decided to work for the church. And he became the servant of Father Henry Garnet, who was the Jesuit superior in England. And we think probably in the Armada year, 1588, they met. Garnet would have come to the Marshalsea on a regular basis because, as I say, the Marshalsea was the main holding prison for Catholics, so he would minister to his flock. And also Nicholas was in there visiting his brother John, and they become acquainted. And Nicholas took the important pivotal decision to become a servant and work for Garnet, and made himself liable to death for high treason. In the words of the Act Against Jesuits, Seminary Priests, and such like disobedient persons, every person that shall receive, relieve, comfort, aid, or maintain any such Jesuit, Seminary Priest, or other such priest shall be adjudged a felon and suffer death, loss, and forfeit, as in the case of high treason. So Nicholas made himself liable to death. And the most tragic consequence of the Armada coming, that in the eyes of the ordinary person, it linked the Catholic religion with enmity towards England. Pope Sixtus blessed the banner of the fleet before it sailed. He also promised the Spanish a large sum of money to defray expenses. And even made arrangements for a substitute Archbishop of Canterbury, a guy called William Allen. And Allen prepared a pamphlet which attacked Elizabeth as an incestuous bastard, begotten and born in sin of an infamous courtesan, Anne Bullen, afterwards executed for adultery, heresy, and incest. So it's now easy and plausible for preachers to denounce Catholics as traitors who wanted another country to take over, and that caused, and there was a marked change in the attitude of ordinary people towards Catholics, whereas before there'd been sympathy and tolerance because of the change backwards and forwards. So in August and November alone of the Armada year, 17 priests were captured and were put to death. Some of them were already in prison and captured, but others were captured. 17, an enormous number. Well, Garnet often was always moving his safe houses from place to place, but at the time we're writing, he had one in Finsbury Fields, which is there, and just south. This is the London Wall, and there's the Moorgate out of the City of London onto the Moor, and his house was in quite an isolated house up there, and he gave orders for extra security. He gave orders that the house was to be gave the appearance of being uninhabited, and you were not to speak in a natural voice for fear of being overheard, and no fires would be lit even in the worst wet weather. The food was cooked overnight and eaten cold the next day. So those are the conditions in which Nicholas had to live within at the start of his service. And it was also where he built what was almost certainly his first priest hole in the cellar of that house, behind an untidy store of coals and timber. Despite all these precautions, they faced ruin when a priest ignorant of the rules visited the house in the daytime. He was recognised and the constable was called. Another of Garnet's servants, Hugh Selden, was in the house at the time, and he put his head out of the window and asked what they want, and they answered, "The constable in the Queen's name is ordering you to open the door." "Open the door to you? Why, pray?" Hugh asked. "We must examine the house. The man here, whom we have just arrested, has come into it. There is no doubt he is a priest." "Off with you," retorted Hugh. "You merely imagine he is a priest because you want to cause my master trouble. How am I to know you are not thieves that want to sack the house? I should be blunt with you. I'm not going to allow anyone in today. If you use force, it will be at your own peril. I shall defend my master's house." So the constable left his men to watch the house and went off to get the Chief Justice of Middlesex, Richard Young. And Young arrived, and Hugh immediately became conciliatory, let Young in, but of course in the delay he'd hidden all the vestments, letters and other incriminating matters in Nicholas's priest hole. So Young found nothing of consequence and left. Hugh was able to burn the evidence and make his own escape. Well, later that same year, Garnet called a general meeting of all Jesuits at Baddesley Clinton in Warwickshire, a lovely, lovely house in the hands of the National Trust. And as a precaution, he'd asked Nicholas to construct a large priest hole, and if we look at the back of the house now, you'll see these loopholes at the just above the moat. They, in fact, were a guardrail tunnel for sewage, which is led out into the moat. And it was large; it was fairly large because a servant could go along, clean it and maintain it as necessary. And of course, there was a problem because if the house was raided, you could capture and wipe out the entire Jesuit community in one easy motion. And in fact, the house was raided a day after the meeting had ended. Fortunately, a number of the priests already left, and it was dawn, and four pursuivants hammered at the door demanding entrance. A servant held them off, while the priests rushed around stripping the altar and gathering up vestments, books and anything else that might betray them. And one person was told to turn the mattresses upside down. This was done so that if they felt the mattress, it would feel cold and wouldn't betray that somebody sleeping there. Then they all scrambled into Nicholas's priest hole. There's a picture of it. Fairly large, but there were 10, it needed to be, because there were 10 people, 5 Jesuit priests, 2 seminary priests, and 3 lay gentlemen who were on the run. Nicholas is not listed in the report, so he's probably just, as he wasn't known to the authorities, he simply mingled with the other servants. And Baddesley Clinton was leased by 2 remarkable ladies, Anne Vaux and a widowed sister, Eleanor. They were the daughters of a noble recusant family, and they spent their time and fortune, we'll hear from them again as the story goes on, they're helping the Catholic cause, in this case by offering a safe house for Jesuits, at of course the risk of their own lives. Unfortunately, we don't have any portraits of either of them. They've disappeared over the centuries. The elder sister, Eleanor, who was a nominal leaseholder, felt too nervous to confront the pursuivants. So it's her younger sister, Anne, who came forward, pretended to be Eleanor, and confronted them. "Does it seem right or proper that you should be admitted into a widow's house before either she or her maids or her children have risen?" she demanded. Eventually, she had to let them in, and they spent a few hours searching, but found nothing. And in the end, they went, and Gerard and the others were able to come out, but they weren't in very good shape because they spent 4 hours doubled up. It's been quite a small passage. And in addition, at the time, it was there was several inches of water from the moat, and their feet had the feet in the water all the time. But at least they survived, of course. One of Garnet's most effective men was a very active Jesuit called John Gerard, and at the time he was based in a recusant home in East Anglia called Broad Oaks Manor, or Braddocks, which is that's a modern picture of it. The year after the Baddesley-Clinton raid, this house also was searched, and Gerard was absent at the time. They did find an old Marian priest behind a panel, and he was arrested. And Garnet was concerned by this and arranged that Christmas for Nicholas to go and build a priest hole. And this is it. At the top of the house, the old chapel, he cut down into the fireplace and removed about 2 cubic metres of brick and excavated a hole big enough to hold a man. And the entrance to it was very makeshift. What he did, he just put pieces of wood across and then laid bricks on. This is a more modern reproduction, but he put bricks on top of it because they never intended for the fire to be lit there, although they did leave logs and so forth there to make it look as if the fire was in use. And anyway, one of the servants, there was a traitor in the household named John Frank, a servant. And at Easter 1594, he saw his chance because Gerard was there, and he hurried off to trip off the pursuants who raided the house. And Gerard was put into this hide at very short notice. He had no time to grab any food or drink. And here it is noticeable that just 3 years after Baddesley Clinton, the search is much more thorough. In Baddesley Clinton, they just took four hours or so. In this raid, they took 4 days. And they first of all isolated all the entire family, put them out to another house. Then they measured, used a sounding hammer on walls and so forth. Very much a coordinated professional search. But they didn't find anything. But the night before they gave up, some soldiers actually lit because it was cold. Lit a fire in that grate, and the wood wasn't able to take this. And it started to burn through, and the soldiers noticed that things started to fall down to a cavity. But they said to each other, apparently it's a very curious matter, and they thought they'd look into it the next day. But in fact, they forgot, and Gerard is convinced this was by divine providence, because if they even peered down between the bricks, he said they would have seen him. But lastly, he could come out very wasted from lack of food and drink, and from being in such a confined space for days. But he survived. So this is the picture from inside the hide. So just very crudely carved out, and you're looking up into the hearth there. So again, in bad shape, but he survived. So even in these just first few years of service, Nicholas's work had saved a lot of lives. Unfortunately, in this case, the fact that John Frank was the traitor wasn't known. But following escape, John Gerard returned to London, and he needed to find his suitable lodging, and he recalls he asked Nicholas to arrange these for him. And Nicholas apparently was quite used to this, Gerard describes him as that excellent man who was so experienced in transactions of this sort. This also shows that, in fact, Nicholas was lent out by Garnet to whichever Jesuit should need him. We'll see evidence of this later on. And while he was making the move in, he sent a letter back to Braddocks, and a letter was sent in reply, but calamitously it was sent by the hand of John Frank. And as soon as John Frank had delivered it and satisfied himself that Gerard was present, he went off and got pursuers. And they came and they arrested. They broke in upon Gerard and Nicholas when they were in bed, and took them away to the Poultry Compter, a prison run by a sheriff. Here's an engraved, not much later engraved, but it lasted. It was still running for a century or two afterwards. And there, according to Gerard, they first tried bribery and coaxing. Then they threats. And when those didn't work, they just turned to torture. And Gerard says they were hung up for 3 hours together, having their arms fixed into iron rings and their bodies hanging in the air, a torture which causes frightful pain and intolerable extension of the sinews. This was all to no purpose. No disclosure could be wrested from them that was hurtful to others. No rewards could entice, no threats or punishments forced them to discover where I or any of ours had been harboured, or to name any of our acquaintances or betters. This, in fact, in these days, apparently this was the shackles, as they're called, were much more common than the rack. I suppose they're easier to arrange, but you see there, you're hung up basically by the wrists, and with a weight on your feet. Nicholas as I say, they couldn't get anything out of him, but he languished in the poultry for some time, not sure exactly how long, and then some Catholic gentlemen paid a large sum of money to have him released, possibly at the instigation of Garnet, who would have missed his expert help. It does seem strange to us that you could actually just pay money to get out of a prison, but that was the way civil prisons were run as a business by the sheriff, and were a law unto themselves. They actually competed among themselves for the custody of the most lucrative detainees. They were charged for food, drink, medical attention, and so on. And somebody like Nicholas, who couldn't pay his way, was simply a drain on the sheriff's resources. So he was free. But Gerard, naturally, as a Jesuit priest, couldn't be released. But he did, by paying a large bribe to the sheriff. He got moved to the Clink prison on the south bank of the Thames, which was much more comfortable. And Gerard was able to talk to other Catholics, say Mass, and receive letters. And he was kept there for 3 years. And coincidentally, within that time, Nicholas's brother Henry, who you remember became a printer, was also imprisoned there, been printing Catholic books and pamphlets. And they caught him and put him in the Clink. And apart from that, also yet another John Garnet's servant, John Lilly, a senior servant, was also imprisoned there. So it was quite cosy. And Henry, it says, it's an interesting sideline. He had no intention of imprisonment hinder his work, and managed to get a printing press, into his cell. Another printer complained to Parliament. He got so bold at last, he contrived to bring in his press with him to the Clink prison, and there printed Polish books. And it's amazing what bribery could do for you in those days. And during this time that Henry mentions Nicholas for the first time in one of his letters to his superiors in Rome. 1596, he says, "We maintain a number of necessary lay helpers, and among them a carpenter. Sometime, God willing, he will join the society. His singular faithfulness and skill make him most suited for its work. He has travelled almost the entire kingdom, and without charge has made for Catholic priests hiding places where they can shelter from the fury of heretical searchers." So Nicholas came regularly to the prison to visit his brother and to take messages to and from John Gerard and of course John Gilly, his fellow servant. And Gerard lay in the Clink for 2 to 3 years. But one day, an apostate priest, William Atkinson, also imprisoned there, told the prison authorities he had witnessed Gerard giving Nicholas a packet of letters for Garnet. And as soon as they found out that Gerard was in contact with Garnet, they moved him to the Tower, where they could torture him in more comfort and try and find out more about what was going on. Again, they put him in the shackles for a long time, until he fainted and couldn't be revived. On one occasion, he fainted and couldn't be revived for some hours. So they realised he was on the point of death, and they didn't actually want to kill people. it was bad publicity. So they just let him be in his cell for some time. He was kept in the Salt Tower, which is there, which is built into the inner wall of the tower. And he became aware that another Catholic was imprisoned in the Cradle Tower, which is there, built into the outer wall. And he managed, again by bribery, to get in touch with John Arden, who was the gentleman in the other tower. And while they were talking together, they thought, if we could just throw a rope over the moat here, we can slide down it onto the onto the wharf, excuse me, and escape. And so they got they put this plan to Garnet, who approved it, and it's certain that Nicholas would have, as a practical man, would have been involved in the planning of this. And so they made the arrangements. An attempt was made a little later, but it failed. The first attempt failed disastrously. They were swept away. They swept away the incoming tide swept them up, and they were almost killed by being swept against the piles of London Bridge, which is a bit further, 100 yards further upstream in those days than its current location, by the way. Anyway, They were not discouraged by this. The very next day, they came back again, and this time it worked. The prisoners threw a lead ball on a string over the tower, and John Lilly, who was leading the party, attached a rope to it. They pulled up the rope, and managed to shin down. Gerard describes it was very difficult for him because John Arden had gone first. The rope had stretched, and he was slide down. It was almost across, but finally, he managed to get away. And they were then taken to a safe house in Spitalfields, and there they were met by Nicholas with some horses, and he took them to Garnet had at the time in Uxbridge. So this is actually a remarkable achievement to escape from the most feared prison in England. John Gerard, who they just rescued, had no thought of taking a rest. He immediately resumed his missionary work in Northamptonshire. And this time, Elizabeth Vaux, a relation by marriage of the Vaux sisters of Batsy Thinton, offered to lease a house as a base, and they settled on Kirby Hall near Kettering. And Gerard went along for a tour of inspection. He took Nicholas and Hugh Sheldon with him so they could look for good places for priest holes and possibly even begin work. Gerard returned. Word had got round that Lady Vaux was changing at least a remote mansion, and the pursuers raided it. And Nicholas got away over the fields, but Hugh Sheldon was captured. They also, and it was then decided it was impossible to use Kirby Hall for that. So what Lady Vaux did, she built an extra wing onto her seat at Harrowden Hall, and Nicholas built priest holes in that. And of course, as this was a new building, it was much easier for him rather than trying to fit things in afterwards. And certainly, what he put in, and Harrowden Hall was raided after the gunpowder plot, and Gerard again was spent 9 days there without being discovered. So it obviously made some very secure hiding places in it, although Harrowden Hall is now no longer stands. And Garnet now moved his house yet again, this time to a house called White Webs in Enfield, and again the Vaux sisters were leasing it for him and lived there as cover. Two misfortunes befell Nicholas about this time. Firstly, in 1599, Garnet sent him to London to fetch some household goods by horse. He loaded the horse in an inn yard and then got into the saddle with great difficulty because he's a short man and would have to swing his leg over the load, I suppose, a problem for one of his height. And the horse was somewhat resty and would not go forward, whether misliking his load or no, is uncertain. But instead of going forward, it rose so high with his forefeet that he fell backwards and fell upon the man and burst his leg. And Gerard said he bore the pain with great patience, yet stay at the inn, and when it became clear the bone was not knitting properly, they broke it again and reset it. And but Gerard said they admired him at the inn for his patience and virtue, and he was ever after most welcome to the place. And also at that time he suffered a hernia, obviously for lifting. He was getting into his 40s, lifting heavy weights, and he got a hernia, and that must have caused him a great discomfort and inhibited what he could do in the future. It was also in the year 1599 that Garnet wrote to Rome, and again mentions Nicholas. He said, "I am employing certain people who wish to be coadjutors, that is, a lay brother of the Jesuits. All are of the highest reputation. They help me as much as if they'd already been admitted among us. They serve us excellently in the hope before they die, they will be at least coadjutors. I keep one joiner for making secret places in which to hide our money and other things of importance." Now, it does seem strange here that, after all, Nicholas had served for 11 years. He'd built refuges which had saved very many lives. He'd also been imprisoned and strung up in the shackles for hours, without betraying any information, so you'd think he would have been made at least a lay brother, but apparently not. The Jesuits are very, very careful with their honours, and in most biographies and descriptions of Nicholas Owen, you find they say that he was eventually made a Jesuit lay brother, but I'm of the opposite opinion. Garnet wrote another letter on the same subject a few months before he was captured, saying, "Pray you send word now how many coadjutors you would have." So Rome was reluctant to grant that honour, even to the last. So I think perhaps he did not receive that honour. Now, Elizabeth died and was succeeded by James I in 1603. And at first, hopes were high that we'd get tolerance, because, of course, James's mother was Mary, Queen of Scots, the most famous Catholic, and also his wife, Anne of Denmark, was clearly not that enamoured of Protestantism, because she refused communion at the wedding, and Protestant communion at the wedding, and so on. It was thought she was a sympathiser. And also, one of his early actions was to suspend the fines for not attending the state church, which were quite high by that time. So he put his money where his mouth is. He lost quite a lot of money from the treasury, and people were very, very hopeful that would happen. Catholic religion would be tolerated. But a year after that, James said that he confirmed the Catholic priests were forbidden in the kingdom, and not only reintroduced the fines, he demanded arrears, probably because he found it politically impossible. The prejudice against Catholics was just too strong. And at this time, and of course this great disappointment probably made the gunpowder plotters more belligerent. At the same time, John Gerard was changed his lodging once more. He rented a house in London nearer the principal street in London called the Strand. He described it as having private entrances on both sides, and I'd contrived in it some most excellent hiding places. Again, Nicholas would have built those hiding places, as he was worked closely with Gerard at all times. And here's the gunpowder plotters, 1605. And most historians say they met at the Duck and Drake Inn in St Clement's Lane. Lady Antonia Fraser says that, for example, in her book on the gunpowder plot, and Alice Hobb as well. But in fact, I think that's very unlikely, because after the meeting, in Guy Fawkes' confession, he said, in the same house, it being Sunday, they did receive the sacrament of Gerard the Jesuit. Now, Gerard would never have said Mass in full vestments and so forth in an inn, which is a semi-public place. Somebody might have heard the Latin liturgies, they walked past or even walked in. I'm sure they must therefore have met in Gerard's safe house in the Strand, where it was much safer to do that. Well, the plot, of course, failed. And the time the news broke, Garnet and Nicholas were at Calton Court in Warwickshire. And Garnet received a letter, and when being asked what it was about, he said to have replied, "They would have blown up the Parliament House with powder, and they were discovered, and we utterly undone." And King James was not happy about this. He'd lived with the fear of assassination all his life. When he was still in his womb, his mother, Mary Queen of Scots, saw a secretary, Rizzio, stabbed in front of her. When he was an infant, his father was strangled to death. When he was 5, his grandfather was murdered. Mm-hmm. And when he was 16, he himself was kidnapped. Scotland was actually a very rough place at that time. And he gave orders that every effort was to be made to capture those responsible. There's more men and money allocated for the purpose. And Garnet stayed at Calton Court after the disaster for a month, but another Jesuit, Father Edward Oldcourt, who was at a house called Hindlip House nearby, heard that Garnet was a Calton and sent his servant Ralph Ashley to invite him to Hindlip. Now, you see, the main hide in Calton goes down 2 floors in this turret, and it's not particularly safe. One reason being because, as you see, the searchers were always told to go round the house and look at windows and so forth, and they would have seen that there's a window in this turret and nothing in that, and that would have drawn their attention immediately. So I reckon that Nicholas advised Garnet that in fact it wasn't as safe as Hindlip, because Hindlip is now no more, but this is an engraving from it. He'd visited Hindlip on many occasions over the 15 or 16 years, and it was riddled with hiding places. We've seen there's many hiding places there. In January 1606, one of the peripheral figures in the gunpowder plot, Humphrey Littleton, was captured, and faced with execution, he offered in return for his life to give information concerning the Jesuits, and especially that of Father Oldcourt, who said it was at Hindlip. And he thought Garnet was there as well. And this betrayal of his friends didn't help him, as they hanged him anyway. But the pursuivants came and broke on 20th of January 1606. The local magistrates, Sir Henry Bromley, with no less than 100 men, came to break down the doors. And Nicholas and Oldcorn's servants, Ralph Ashley, were hurried into one hide, and the priests the priest garnered an old cordon to another. And the search began. They went on for 3 days, and they found three or four small hides with vestments, prayer books, and so on in them. And then the fourth day, Nicholas and Ralph actually came out and made a bid for freedom. They watched their time when the searchers were furthest off and came out so secretly and stilly and shut the place again so finely they were not one whit heard or perceived when or where they came out. And so they walked in the gallery towards the door, which they thought belike to have found open. But the searchers, being turned back in their walk and perceiving two strange men in there, whom they had not seen before, presently ran unto them and asked what they were. And they answered, there were men that were in the house, and would be content to depart if it pleased them. The others were asked whether they were priests, and they answered they were Catholics, and that further they would not answer. They had been asked where they had been all that while, they answered they had hid themselves, being Catholics, to avoid taking, and being urged to tell or show the place, they absolutely refused. There's still some debate as to why they came out. Sir Henry was convinced because it was January, it was hungry and cold. Some people think that they sacrificed themselves to draw attention away from the priest. They thought coming out would draw attention away. That might be true. Though Garnet was of the opinion that, in fact, that was the worst thing they could have done. He wrote to Anne Vaux after his arrest saying, we had escaped if the first two hidden soldiers had not come out so soon, for when they found them, they were curious to find their place. My guess it might have been thirst, because you can go... I doubt it was hunger, because they knew if they were caught, it would be hanged, drawn, and quartered. It would be better to starve to death, surely. But you can't do without... go for more than a few days without water. But in any case, Sir Henry Bomley was not inclined to give up the search, and he continued for another 4 days, finding no less than 11 hides in total. As I say, the place was riddled with hides, and culminating the discovery of Garnet and Old Corn in a hide built into a chimney. And after giving them some days to recover, he assembled all his prisoners, the two priests, the two servants, and Thomas Habington, the owner of the house, and he took them, escorted them to London. Now, I'll break off here, as I do in my biography, to say a few words about priest holes. We saw the hide in Braddocks that was excavated from inside the wall. And Nicholas did like to excavate, because no amount of measuring will reveal an excavated hide. And he gets a number of examples of that. As we saw, it was rather crude, but one in Sawston Hall, not very far away in East Anglia, is a much better thing. There's a spiral, this is the top of a spiral staircase going up, and just there, the last floors, go over and rest for a foot or so on the wall. And you cut down here, it goes down and under into a larger cavity, almost 3 metres long, able to take a couple of men. And he made up this four walls into a single panel, which could be lazed, and in fact, when it's down, you simply can't see it. It's very finely constructed. So this is what he could do. This would have been towards the end of his career, where he got much more skill than the one at Braddock's, which was, as I say, rather crude. Now, for those of you who like to see more priest holes, the outstanding location is Harvington Hall, and which is in the hands of the Catholic Archdiocese of Birmingham, and is open to the public. And there are no less than 8 hides that we know of in there. Most of them, we think, by Nicholas, because of the quality of their construction. And most of them are grouped around the central staircase, which was replaced about 1600. And we think Nicholas was involved in that construction of the staircase and took the opportunity to build a hide into it. Here's the top of the staircase. You see the two treads with the risers in between them can be raised up and reveal a hole under the stair where they've got a model of a piece hiding. And also, at the back, you see there's brick panels with timber separations. One of those panels over there is missing, but you can see there are hinges and a bolt, and there used to be a hinged panel there, which would have been a brick shims on a wood base, which could swing in and out. And behind that, there's a much larger priest hole. So it's a hide within a hide. So even if they should find it in the staircase, they might well escape because they think the hide was empty. Very, very remarkable piece of work there. Also at Harvington, there's a swinging beam. You see, it looks like there's two structural timbers there. but Nicholas cut it at the top, hinged it, and the bolt at the bottom, and there's just enough room to squeeze in, then it gets a bit larger, so you can hide actually within the wall. And there, as I say, there are several other hominoids. Some of them are rather crude and probably are not of Nicholas's construction, but we're pretty certain these are the best ones are. Now, we can't talk, you see, they're all different, and we can't talk about Nicholas's style of construction as we would for a conventional designer, because he took care not to have a style, because that any sort of signature construction would give a clue. As one source says, yea, he did much strive to make them of several fashions, in several places, the one being taken might give no light to the discovery of another. And so he used many different methods in chimneys, stairs, excavated counters, arches, cupboards, and so on. And very likely there are half-hands to be found. The one at Calton we saw earlier was actually forgotten about and only found in 1945 when they were doing some repair work. So we may see other examples of Nicholas's genius. Yeah. But of course, anyway, going back to Nicholas was now taken to London, initially to the Marshalsea, possibly because they didn't fully realise who he was, but from information extracted on the rack, they did know that a short man with a bad limp was the person who built most priest holes, and so eventually they realised who they had, a very valuable prisoner. And one councillor exulted, "Is he taken that knows all the secret places? I'm very glad of that. We will have a trick for him." And so they took him to the tower where they could torture him in more comfort. And the lieutenant of the tower, Sir William Wade, was personally involved. His name is on the confessions that Nicholas gave. And first confession, he denied knowing anything or anyone. He confesseth that he hath been called by the name of Andrews and knoweth not whether he hath been called by the name of Little John or Draper or any other name than known in Andrews. That he came to Mr. Abington's house, Hindip Hall, the Saturday before he was taken, but refuses to answer from which place he came. So he denied knowing anyone or anything. But obviously the authorities went satisfied with this and put him to torture again and again in the efforts to make him speak. And we have contemporary description of his fate. They tormented him with hideous cruelty. Every day news arrived of freshly devised tortures which he had to suffer. And this went on for many days continually. But the truth is, we do not know the details, even to this day. All we know is that, sometimes for several hours on end, he was subjected to torture. The only sound to be heard from him was one which had long been familiar to him in all hours and times. Sweet Jesus, and Lord, give me your holy grace and patience. And the rackmaster had a practical problem here, because in torturing in the shackles, his hernia gaped and his intestines bulged out. And the solution was to strap a circular metal plate over the hernia, as a sort of primitive truss. In the words of the source, he therefore, being not only tortured, but that with so much extremity and so long continuance, it could not be otherwise but that his bowels should come out, which, when they perceived, and minding yet as to continue that course with him, they girded his belly with a plate of iron to keep in his bowels. Anyway, after 3 days of that, he gave an expanded confession, in which he admitted to having attended Father Garnet on occasions over the last 4 years, rather than the 20 was the truth. And he mentioned some other scraps, but none of them were useful to the authorities, because everybody he mentioned was either a dead, already captured, or in exile. And the same day of that second confession, they put him to the torture again, and he died in the most agonising manner. As far as it was possible to tell, by stretching his body, it forced his intestines out past the metal plate, and the edge of it gashed the intestines so severely that he perished. And the description we have says the torture did force out his guts, and so the iron did but to serve and cut and wound his body. And it's possible, one procedure that they had followed before, for example, was to move you from the shackles to the rack, horizontal rack properly. They did it with guy forks. When put to the gentlest tortures, forks said very little, but after 4 days, Lieutenant Wade was able to write to the Earl of Salisbury saying, he had a full confession after plying him with the best persuasions I could use, or was certainly the rack. So I think the effort of using a windlass rather than the force of gravity forced the hernia out and caused the fatal injury. And abdominal injuries are often not immediately fatal, and it's very likely that Nicholas lingered on in agony for some hours before dying on the night between the 1st and the 2nd of March 1606. And even by the standards of the time, the death was embarrassing, and the authorities gave out that he had committed suicide by slashing his belly with a knife, which the jailer had compassionately given to him. And according to Henry Moore, the great-grandson of St Thomas Moore, he was buried in the churchyard of St Peter ad Vincula in the grounds of the town. There's an image of it now. This used to be a graveyard. And Father John Gerard, who worked with him so closely over so many years, wrote to him, "The truth was this. The man had lived a saintly life, and his death was answerable, and he a glorious martyr of extraordinary merit. God assisted him with so much grace. In all his torments, he gave not the least sign of relenting, nor any sign of impatience, nor any one word which the least of his acquaintance either did or might come into any trouble. In the meantime, I desire my soul may have part with his, and I myself may be assisted with his holy prayers." This is a remarkable thing for a senior Jesuit priest to say of a layman and a servant, and shows the respect he was held. Well, centuries passed after death, in which little could be done because of the prejudice against Catholics, but at last in 1929, Nicholas and many others were beatified, and in 1970, Nicholas was one of 40 men and women who were canonised under the title of the 40 Martyrs of England and Wales. And this painting was commissioned at the time, and we see Nicholas here kneeling in the foreground. At the back, you can see the tower. Thank you.